We're in a series called The Belief Project. The Belief Project is our journey through the Gospel of John. Now, what that means for us is that's kind of our big picture, long-term series. It may take us a while to get through the Gospel of John, because what we do is we pull out of John every once in a while and do a different series for about 4 or 6 weeks, and then we jump back into the Gospel of John. So it's been kind of a slow and methodical process for us to get through the Gospel of John. So by the time we get to the end of John, I may be the same age as one of our most treasured people here at City Church, Mr. Jack Morris, who today is 89 years old. Doesn't he have like the best name ever? Like, he doesn't even have a middle name. It is Jack Morris. I always feel like he walked off the set of a Western movie when I hear that. Hello, I'm Jack Morris. So congratulations, Jack, 89 years old. So I may be Jack's age when we finish up the Belief Project. He told me today he was going to try to outlive Billy Graham, so he's going to be around for a while. But we do teach the Bible here, so we're in John chapter 7 this morning. We saw a clip from To Tell the Truth, the most recent version of To Tell the Truth, which is a revamp again of one of the old TV game shows. There's several old TV game shows making a comeback. I jotted down just a few. $50,000 Pyramid, which did evolve with time. Like, when it started out, it was like the $100 Pyramid, because it was like way back in the day where $100 is a lot of money. And then it kind of evolved to where it's the $50,000 Pyramid now. The Gong Show has made a comeback. Remember that? If you're really horrible, it's just like gong, you get pulled off the stage. The Gong Show's made a comeback. The Match Game has made a comeback. That's an old revamped TV game show. My favorite revamped TV game show, though, is The Joker's Wild. Ready for it? With Snoop Dogg. What? Joker's Wild with Snoop Dogg. That's definitely a different take on the Joker's Wild. But one of my favorites is the old game show that is now a modern game show, To Tell the Truth. If you don't know the gist of the game show, they basically bring three people in who all claim to be the same person, who all claim to be the same thing. So it's usually some crazy, you know, something in life that they all claim to have done. Like, I don't know, sailed across the Atlantic Ocean on a paper airplane. Or I have drunk 10 gallons of gasoline and set myself on fire internally. None of these are real things. I'm making these up as I go, so these aren't real things that were on the show, but you get the idea. It's always something crazy. They all three claim to have done that. And then the people on the show have the opportunity to ask questions to try to figure out which one of them is telling the truth. In that particular instance, it was someone that milks poisonous snakes. And so at the end, the host will always say, will the real, whatever it is, please stand up? And only one of them is real. And that person will stand up. And then the three people that were trying to guess, they get points. Well, throughout the Gospel of John, there has been this kind of underlying question, this ongoing conversation with people. Is Jesus for real? Is Jesus telling the truth? Is Jesus who he claims to be? And interesting enough, in our text today, even his own brothers are asking that question. Now, let me give us a quick review and bring us up to speed. Some of you are new to City Church and you haven't been a part of the Belief Project. And then if you're like the rest of us, a lot of us just kind of forget what was going on. The Gospel of John was written by one of Jesus' best friends, the Apostle John. He was part of the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. So he spent a lot of quality time with Jesus, one of the best friends of Jesus. And so literally, when we read the story of John, we are reading it from an insider's perspective. We are getting in on inside information about who Jesus is from one of his very best friends. So, interesting perspective when we read the Gospel of John, what John has to tell us about who Jesus is. John is a storyteller. He allows us to listen in on conversations that Jesus is having with all these different types of people. So basically, he's telling the story of Jesus, and it's almost like he pulls us to the side and says, hey, listen to this story. Listen to this dialogue that Jesus had with this religious leader. Listen to this story, this dialogue that Jesus had with this person. And we realize that some of those dialogues turn into kind of a discourse that Jesus gives, a teaching that Jesus gives. But John allows us to listen in. Now, like a good storyteller, a good book writer, John gives us, at the very end of his book, the purpose. Like, he lays it out for us why he wrote the story of Jesus. I'll remind us of these words from John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. Very interesting. Like John says, I'm not giving you everything. I'm just giving you a glimpse. But then he gives us his purpose in verse 31. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John lays it out for us. Don't forget the purpose of this entire story. The entire gospel is twofold. One, it is to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. That's why we call this the Belief Project, because everything about this is about that idea of believing who Jesus is. And John, through six chapters, has laid out for us who Jesus is. He's made this kind of compelling case for who Jesus claims to be. He starts out in chapter 1 telling us that Jesus is the eternal God, the Word, who became flesh. That this is a unique story. Like John doesn't start where Matthew, Mark, and Luke even start. John starts in eternity. He says this eternal God became flesh. This is a unique story. It's the story of what he calls a lamb who will take away the sin of the world. In chapter 2, John reminds us that Jesus was also concerned about the details of life. That he went to a wedding where they ran out of wine and Jesus made wine. That he is concerned about the details of life. He's the maker of new things. In this case, the maker of wine. He is Lord of the Sabbath. He's like not confined to the religious structures of his day. In chapter 3, he allows us to listen in on an important conversation with a guy named Nicodemus. Nicodemus, who was a Pharisee, who was a religious leader. John, the insider, allows us to listen to the conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus. And in that conversation, Jesus tells Nicodemus, I am the source of eternal life. That to have eternal life, you must be born a second time. You must be born again. And then right in the heart of that, he gives us what became probably the most popular verse in all the Bible, that God so loved the world, he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him has life. And so we kind of sit on the sidelines and listen in as Jesus has this conversation in chapter 3 to remind us and to remind Nicodemus, I'm the giver of eternal life, he says. In chapter 4, he has this conversation with an exact opposite person of Nicodemus. He makes his way into the land of Samaria, goes out of his way, which was unheard of for a Jewish man to do, to even pass through Samaria. They hated Samaritans. Samaritan hated Jews. And yet Jesus goes into this context. He goes into Samaria for one purpose. To have a conversation with a lady that we learned was basically a very unsavory person in her community, right? She was at the well in the heat of the day because she didn't want to be around people. And we sit around with Jesus in Jesus' conversation and we hear Jesus talk to her and to reach out to her and to break all the social norms to tell her that you're searching for something and I'm the source of living water. Like your thirsty soul can be fulfilled in me. And we get to listen in on that conversation. In chapter 5, John writes the story of Jesus as he goes into this area and goes directly to this man who has been condemned to live a life of leprosy and has been ostracized from everyone. And we see Jesus as the healer of the isolated as he goes and expresses healing and forgiveness and redemption to this man and reminds us in John's gospel that he is the healer of the isolated. And in the context of this, Jesus claims that he's God. Like the reason I have the authority to heal is because of who I am, because I'm the Son of God. And the religious leaders at that time began to hate and despise him and want him dead. And then in chapter 6, where we kind of left off, Jesus is teaching in the desert. He's fed all of these people with bread and fish, and he's telling them that they're really missing out on the big thing. It's not like about the physical bread, but it's about the idea that he is the bread of life. That brings spiritual nourishment to spiritually hungry souls. The internal hunger that is in our eternal souls. That Jesus brings satisfaction to that. And so from the opening pages of his story, John reminds us of who Jesus is. The giver of life, the eternal Son of God. All of these things working toward this purpose to believe who Jesus is. Believe Jesus is the Christ. And these bold, audacious claims of Jesus, man, they cause like colossal division among the people. It's not his miracles that stir people up. It's his words. That Jesus claims that he's equal with God, the giver of life, and
there's kind of this attitude among the people like, man, we love the miracles of Jesus. Like, can we just tap into this like supernatural power that Jesus is showing? Like, we love the miracles. And in the desert in John 6, they're like, man, we're into this like bread for a lifetime. Like, we like bread. We love bread. Can we tap into this bread resource? I had an Oprah Winfrey flashback in my mind right then. Remember like new Weight Watchers commercials? I love bread. Jesus, like the people in the desert were like, we love bread. Can we get some more of this bread? Can we be healed? Can we have this kind of ongoing relationship and Jesus will just meet our needs? That's what they were looking for. But Jesus is more than just the miracles. It's his words that's causing such anger and hostility. John has brought witnesses in, hasn't he? We've heard from different witnesses throughout the gospel of who Jesus is. He allowed us to listen to John the Baptist talk about Jesus. The miracles talk about Jesus. Jesus even says in John 5 that the Father himself confirms who he is, that the scriptures confirm who Jesus is, that Moses was pointing ahead to Jesus. Repeatedly, John places us in the story for one reason, so that we might believe. That we may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Now, the people in the story have believed. There's people in the story who have not believed. And there's people in the story who have believed. And John gives us names. He gives us real life people. Now, what's interesting about the best friend of Jesus telling the story is he gives us names and people that he knew, that he rubbed shoulders with, that he spent time with. It's not just a fable for John. It's not just a Disney story for John. It's not just about, hey, I heard about these people. John introduces into the story people he knew, he spent time with, he rubbed shoulders with. When he writes the name Nicodemus, he knows Nicodemus. When he talks about Philip and Nathanael and Peter, he knows Philip and Nathanael. His best friend was Peter. And so he introduces us to these real life characters in the story, Philip and Nathanael and Andrew and Nicodemus, the Samaritan woman, the leper. These are people, they're real life people. People filled with doubts, people that have sinned, people with quirks, people with struggles, everyday people living their faith out in the grind of life. People just like us, like John brings us into the story. This is the story of Jesus, written so that you might believe. So that in 2018, we can enter into the story that John is writing so that we might believe. But the belief is not just for belief. John's purpose says, you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you might have life. The purpose is really about life. Belief that leads to life, that generates life. And the implication of that is that where there is no belief, there is no life. Where there is no salvation, no second birth, there is no true life. And for that reason, the words of Jesus have generated this kind of dual response that we see in the story. There are people who believe, and there are people who turn away in unbelief. And John records all these different types of responses, doesn't he? Like people who are antagonistic against Jesus, people who are skeptical, people who are open and receptive, people who are curious, people who are ignorant, people who are just angry and hate who Jesus is. And as we enter into chapter 7, we recognize that there's this kind of growing division, this growing hostility toward Jesus, that there are these polar opposite reactions, belief and unbelief. And these opposite reactions will just heighten as the story continues, as the tension builds. As a matter of fact, we kind of felt it at the end of chapter 6. If you remember, I'll reread these verses because they're so important. Jesus had performed all these miracles, and then again, his words cause all this controversy because Jesus says, hey, you think you're getting this physical bread, but in reality, I am the bread of life. And if you want true life, you've got to eat of my flesh and drink of my blood. And people are like, do what? Like, eat your flesh and drink your blood. This is too much for me to wrap my mind around. And then there's these interesting verses at the end of chapter 6 where John says, After this, after all this happened, these words, this back and forth dialogue, after this, many of his disciples, huge word, many of his followers, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. It's too much. His words were too tough. His words brought too much controversy. So Jesus turns to his 12 and he says, do you want to go away as well? And Simon Peter answers him. And I love this. It's kind of one of my life theme verses. Like Peter says, Jesus, like, Lord, to whom else shall we go? Like, you and you alone have the words of eternal life. Like, we have nowhere else to go, Jesus. It's you. Like, you're our only source of life. We don't have anywhere else to turn. We don't have anywhere else to go. And, like, that's the story of so many of you and so many of me. Like, where else are we going to turn? Like, it's Jesus or nothing. Like, I'm all in with Jesus. And Peter reminds us of the divide that happens between belief and unbelief. And that those who embrace belief, it's like, this is where we don't have anywhere else to turn but this. It's Jesus and Jesus alone. Where else will we go? And he kind of leaves us with this tension. And here's what John's saying to us. Where do we stand in the Jesus story? Where do we stand? When it comes to belief and unbelief, like, where are we? And he puts us into the story so that we might examine our hearts. Like, do we believe? Where do we stand? On which side do we stand? Belief or unbelief? It really comes down to that. Is Jesus who he claims to be? What is my response to Jesus? There's no middle ground here. Jesus doesn't leave us with middle ground. Just like the people in Jesus' day. It is a question with which we must wrestle and struggle. So let's jump back in to chapter 7. Now I've kind of brought us up to speed. I know you're thinking, man, that took a long time to bring us back to speed. Like, how long is this message going to be? Verse 1, chapter 7. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. So based on, let me kind of put this into a chronological timetable for you. Based on the festivals, the Jewish festivals that are mentioned in these two chapters, the text is basically implying that what happens in chapter 7 is about 6 months from the end of chapter 6. So between chapter 6 and chapter 7, we have about 6 months. John's not writing like a chronological story of Jesus. Remember, his purpose is to generate belief. So he puts us into the story. Where he believes we should be in the story. And so basically John says, look, Jesus keeps doing his thing around Galilee. He's very leery about going to Judea because he is worried that the religious authorities there will kill him. By the way, they want to kill him. So, like, he should be leery. If we were to look back in chapter 5, it says, like, they were looking for every opportunity they could to kill him. So, like, Jesus is like, well, I'm not going back to Judea because they want to kill me over there, and I don't want to be killed right now. So he stayed in Galilee for a while. Now, let me make this is so sidetracked right now, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. But I do want to make a side note here that just says, remember, in the story of Jesus as told by John, we have this six-month window where there's no, like, big miracles. There's no, like, massive healings that John records. What's Jesus doing? He's, like, hanging out with the 12. Like, that's how discipleship happens. He's like hanging out with the 12 in the grind of life. Every day at the dinner table, walking the streets, interacting with people, Jesus is investing in the 12 disciples. He's growing them. That's where true discipleship happens. Like, we love the big momentous moments. We love the healings and the kind of big supernatural events. But the everyday grind of life is where following Jesus really happens. Like, it happens. That's where we get to know Jesus and the need to know, need to grow moments of life. That's where Jesus invests in us to grow us into being more like him. Between the miracles, between the big stuff, living life, asking the questions at the dinner table, that's where Jesus is investing in his followers. And then verse 2, there's this kind of shift that happens. Now, the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. So there's shift in the story. John makes note of this huge Jewish fall celebration called the Feast of Booths. Let me, again, kind of give you some history here. There were three primary pilgrimages that the Jews would take to Jerusalem, and most Jewish men in particular were expected to come. One of those was the Feast of Booths. The other was Passover, and the other was Pentecost, and then what's called in the Old Testament and into the New Testament, the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. These three events were centered on the kind of agricultural cycle of that day. So the Feast of Booths happened in the fall, what would be kind of our October-ish. So in the fall, autumn season, when harvest was happening, they would get together in Jerusalem and celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now here's what they did during the Feast of Booths. For 7 days in the Feast of Booths, for one solid week, they lived in booths. Lived in booths, like they hung out in booths. And I know you're all like, man, that's weird. Now, let's go get the tent out of the garage and go camping, right? So like, this is their camping, like lived in the booths for 7 days. And that time of living in the booths was a time of reflection. Traces all the way back to when Moses brought the Jewish people out of Egypt and they lived in portable tents, booths, tabernacles in the desert time. So it was a time of reflection upon what God had brought them from, what God had brought them out of. It was a time of sacrifice. There was a lot of sacrifices that happened during this week. It was a time of deep worship. And so this festival of booths reminded them of God's protection. There was two important symbols, two important kind of rituals that happened during that week. We'll talk about these in the week to come, that reminded them of life in the desert. One had to do with drawing water. Water was very important. When the Jewish people were living in the desert, God would provide water. They often had to draw water. And so they had some rituals that reminded them of their need for water. And then lamp lighting was also a second symbol that took place during the Feast of Booths. And we'll see how Jesus refers to those later in chapter 7. But obviously the light symbolism reminded them of how God guided them through the desert as a pillar of fire. And so you had this, a lot of deep ritualism and symbolism that went along with this. And so that's kind of the overview of what was happening at the Feast of Booths. It was a deep symbolic time of the year when you're expected to come to Jerusalem and remember and sacrifice and worship. So that's the context Jesus is stepping into. Check out verse 3 of chapter 7. So his brothers, what? We haven't heard anything about the brothers, right? Now suddenly the brothers are introduced into the story. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For the first time, John introduces into the narrative the brothers of Jesus. But they're not just the brothers of Jesus. They're kind of the self-appointed campaign team for Jesus, right? You hear what they said to Jesus? Like, stop doing things in secret. Jesus, we have some advice for you. There are people always looking to give you some advice. Man, I've got some advice for you. Here's usually how we phrase it in the South. I'll tell you what I'd do. By the way, I'd is not a word. It's not like the contraction for I would, right? So I'll tell you what I'd do. And I always say, like, if the phrase I tell you what I'd do is prefaced with whatever advice they're going to give you, like the fact that we use the word I'd, probably disqualifies you from the advice, right? But I tell you what I do. Anytime someone phrases something with that, tell you what I do, then you're probably going to ignore the rest of what they say, right? So this is Jesus's I tell you what I do moment from his brothers. And I love what his brothers do here. His brothers have it all figured out. They have a marketing plan. They say to Jesus, look, one, you got to advertise. Like, you need to go to Jerusalem. That's a larger arena. Galilee is too small. Galilee is living out in the sticks. Galilee's where we live. We live out in a county not to be named that you make fun of and ridicule. It's okay. We have running water out there and indoor plumbing, regardless of what you think. We live out in the sticks. We're in Galilee. And Jesus' brothers are like, get out of Galilee. It's too small. Go public. We need to take this to J-Town, to Jerusalem. We need to take this to Judea. They want to advertise. They also want to organize. We got to gather the fan base. Jesus, you have touched thousands of people, multitudes of people. Lots have been healed by you. Many have been fed by you. We need to get them together. We have to organize the fan base. Man, that is a common concept in today's political climate, isn't it? We got to organize the fan base. I'm going to tweet and get everybody together that needs to be in Jerusalem. We're going to get them all together and organize the fan base. They also want Jesus to strategize. Jesus, you have a horrible game plan. You're hiding out in Galilee. You need to go to Jerusalem. You need to get out there, shake some hands, kiss some babies, do something. Get in the spotlight. There's too much at stake. Advertise, organize, strategize. And then they want Jesus to publicize. Like, show people what you can do. Make yourself known to the public. Like Jesus, those public miracles you do, like feeding thousands of people with a single loaf of bread, that's two thumbs up. Like, we've got to publicize this thing. Man, they have it all figured out, don't they? Leave Galilee, go to Jerusalem, organize, strategize, advertise, publicize. Jesus, we've got to get this thing on the front page. Here's the problem with the plan of the brothers of Jesus. Look at verse 5. For not even his brothers believed in him. They didn't even believe in him. Jesus, go public. Make yourself known. We got to get out there. We got to get in the spotlight. The problem is, they don't even believe. They are working from their own agenda. Can you sense some kind of sibling rivalry going on here? Like, Jesus' brothers. Jesus, we need to make you known for our own agenda. A little bit of sibling rivalry going on here. And can we, I mean, let's be honest, can we blame them? Like, these guys are brothers to Jesus. Do you think they ever got tired of Mary saying, like, why can't you be more like your brother? Because he's the living Son of God. That's why. I don't know how it all went down. Like, Jesus taking a bath with his brothers, like, walking on top of the bathwater, like, I don't know how it all happened, but there was definitely some sibling rivalry going on to the point they didn't even believe in him. And if you heard you need to be a little more like your brother a few thousand times, there's probably going to be a bigger agenda here for the brothers. Here's the sobering reality. Even the brothers of Jesus did not believe in him at this time. Now, we know at least one did later, James, who wrote one of our books in the New Testament. But at this time, his brothers did not even believe in him. They had their own plan. They had their own agenda. What's in it for us, Jesus? How can we take advantage of your popularity? How can we take advantage of your notoriety? But Jesus was not there to advertise or organize or strategize or publicize. He for sure was not there to compromise. He had an agenda, but it was a divine agenda. He was on his Father's itinerary. Look what verse 6 says. Here's how Jesus responds. Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. Jesus was on a divine timetable. He said, my time has not come yet. Jesus is not on our itinerary. He wasn't on the agenda of his brothers, and he's not on our itinerary, our agenda. And I have to tell you, sometimes as a follower of Jesus, that's a tough lesson for me to learn. Like, Jesus, I need it to happen like this, in this way. I kind of have my own agenda for Jesus too. And I kind of pray that way and live life that way. And then I'm reminded, like, to this week, and I'm reminded, like, in this text, like, God's saying, like, this is my deal. This is my timetable, and you're on my timetable, and you're not on your agenda. You're on mine. There's a bigger picture happening. Can I tell you something today? Some of you are in some stuff, and you need to hear that His timing may not be your timing. His timing may not be my timing. Jesus said, my time has not yet come. There's a bigger picture unfolding. And the words of Jesus are generating a lot of feelings. They're generating feelings of hostility. They're generating feelings of hatred. I mean, Jesus uses some very vivid language here, doesn't he? Like sometimes this language, it doesn't fit in kind of our Jesus loved everybody and everybody loved Jesus mentality. It's like Jesus says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. Man, those are some vivid words that sometimes undermines our everybody loved Jesus idea. Actually, when we read the text, those who did not believe in him eventually hated him and wanted him dead. That's how he ended up on the cross. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think that 2,000 years of church history will show that unbelief in Jesus eventually leads to hostility and hatred and assault. I mean, read history. Read what has happened when the claims of Jesus and unbelief collide. Eventually, unbelief becomes more than unbelief. It becomes hostility and hatred and doing whatever it takes. I mean, our early church fathers, Tertullian, a famous early church father, said that the church was built, the seed of the church was the blood of the martyrs. That the church grew in hostile environments because unbelief eventually leads to hostility, as we will see in the story of Jesus. And Jesus reminds his brothers, this is not my timetable. I'm on the Father's itinerary, and this doesn't always end like we think it should end. And again, a lot of this hostility is tied to the name of religion. And that's not uncommon in church and throughout history either. In the name of religion, doing things is reaction to unbelief. So look how this story unfolds. Verse 8, Jesus says to his brothers, you go up to the feast. I'm not going up to the feast. My time has not fully come. And after saying this, he remained in Galilee. So Jesus sends his brothers on ahead. You guys go ahead without me. You think Jesus muttered under his breath in that moment, see how you like execution? Probably not. I would have. But Jesus sends his brothers on ahead, right? You guys go ahead to Judea. I'm going to stay in Galilee. And that's what he does. He remains in Galilee until his brothers are gone. Very smart move, it seems like, for Jesus to stay in Galilee because people in Jerusalem wanted him dead. All the people are going to be in Jerusalem. Seems like a hostile territory. So Jesus says to his brothers, you guys go ahead. I'm going to stay here in Galilee. And that's what he does. And then he secretly follows them there. Look at verse 10. Typical brother move. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up. Not publicly, but in private. Jesus says, you go ahead. You got this plan to advertise and strategize and publicize. You guys go ahead. I'm going to stay in Galilee. And that's exactly what he does until they are gone. And then he goes in secret. Because again, there's a bigger picture going on here. Now, look what's going on. We'll read these three verses, and then we'll wind it up today. Look what's going on in Jerusalem, in Judea, during the festival of Booths. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, where is he? And there was much muttering about him among the people. Some said, he's a good man. Others said, no, he is leading the people astray. Yet, interesting verse, for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly about him. There's this buzz happening at the festival about Jesus. The religious authorities are watching for him. People are talking about him. The word here in the original language is the idea of muttering. It's the idea of a kind of widespread whispering going on. Maybe this was a Baptist church. I don't know. A lot of widespread whispering. Come on, I grew up Baptist. I can pick on them. A lot of widespread whispering going on in the church. A lot of responses. Some saying, he's okay, he's cool, feeds hungry people, other people saying. He's a conniving liar, a con artist who's trying to con people. But the one thing that characterized all the murmuring is no one spoke openly and publicly about it out of fear for the religious authorities. These guys are powerful. They are to be feared. They're powerful and scary. What's Jesus doing? What's John doing? John's setting the stage for some crazy controversy. Jesus is going to secretly enter Jerusalem during this humongous festival with this buzz of conflicting opinions about who he is. There's open hostility and anger. There's curiosity. There's skepticism. There's genuine belief. It seems like, from the outside looking in, this might be a good time for Jesus to remain incognito, to remain secret, to remain undercover, to remain hidden. It seems like this is a good time for Jesus to remain private, to remain in secret. But that is the opposite of what he does, as we will see next week. You know why he does the opposite? Because as John has reminded us repeatedly, those who are confronted with the story of Jesus, those who are confronted with the claims of Jesus, us, we are in the story, right? We're part of the story as John tells it. We're listening in on the conversations. We're seeing the dialogue. We're seeing the controversy with the brothers. John reminds us repeatedly, those who are confronted with the claims of Jesus are forced into this crossroads of belief. Is he true? Is he false? What do I do with Jesus? His claims are too significant to dismiss. They're too weighty to ignore. Either Jesus is who he claims to be or he's not. Now, responses, we, reading into the story in 2018, the responses are still the same. Like, you go ask people about Jesus, what they think about Jesus, you're going to get these same responses. He was a good man. He was a charlatan. He was a liar. He was a cult leader. He was a legend. He was a good person who did good things. He's a way to kind of promote my own agenda. I'll tag team with Jesus and get some stuff done. He's good for the resume. The problem is, we're not left with that option. Jesus doesn't give us those options. It's not just, is Jesus a good man? If the things he claimed about himself are not true, he's a horrible man. He's a liar. He's a con artist. Like, we're not left with the option that Jesus is just a good moral person that did some good things. In John's day and in our day today, we are only left with two options. It is true or it is untrue. Belief or unbelief. That is the option with which we are left. And John makes it even more controversial. Jesus makes it more controversial when he says this. By the way, those who believe are the only ones who are truly alive. It's not just belief or unbelief. Jesus, John, takes it to the next level. And by the way, only those who believe are those who are truly alive. Everyone else, dead people, spiritually dead, men, women, boys, girls. Those are controversial words. In Jesus' day, in our day. And as Jesus moves in the pages of John's gospel, as Jesus moves today through his followers, he unmasks this opposition wherever he goes. Whenever we preach the gospel, we are asking people to put Jesus on trial, belief or unbelief. The gospel exposes our hearts. It lays bare our beliefs about the most central figure in all of human history. And it asks us the question, when we preach the gospel, when we hear the gospel, when we live the gospel, it asks us repeatedly the question, what are you going to do with Jesus? Don't miss that reality. Following Jesus generates belief and opposition. Not just from the non-religious, let this sink in, but from the religious. I think we're seeing it as culture unfolds and as time moves forward. Following Jesus secretly, it's not an option. Following Jesus covertly is not an option. And guess what? If you have experienced life in Jesus, you can't hide it. You don't want to hide it. I was a spiritually dead person who's been made alive in Jesus. I'm alive. Like, I don't want to hide that. I don't want to hide that I'm a follower of Jesus. I don't want to hide that I am a person on the journey that's figuring it out. But at the end of the day, I'm not the person with answers, but I know who is. I know the person with answers. That's who I'm following. I'm a follower of Jesus. I'm more alive than I've ever been. Why would I ever hide that? Why would I ever try to live as a secret, covert, undercover Christian? I've been brought to life. And John brings Jesus into real life for us. From the opening pages of his gospel, he says, there is this eternal God. There is this eternal God who was God and is God. And by the way, this eternal God became flesh. He moved into our neighborhoods. He experienced what it was like to be human. He interacted with real people in real life. The Word of God became flesh and lived among us. John makes Jesus real. And what that says to me is, what am I going to do with Jesus in the everyday life, in the grind, when following Jesus is popular and when it's unpopular, when it's loved and when it's despised? What am I going to do following Jesus? I want to give you this reminder and then we're done. As we walk this journey of belief, as we live in this belief project, do not forget the itinerary of the Father. Day in and day out, as we live as husbands and wives and dads and mothers and single adults and people that have been married multiple times or have kids or no kids or stepkids or grandkids or nieces, nephews, as workers and co-workers and retired people, as we live in the everyday of life, no matter where you are and what's going on in your life, as we live in the everyday of life, we remember that there is a sovereign divine plan, a sovereign divine timetable, a sovereign divine heavenly Father agenda, where God is placing people in your path. He is placing people in your space. He is placing people in your sphere of influence. He is placing people in your world to point them to Jesus. There's a plan that is happening, an itinerary, and a heavenly agenda as you live out this journey of belief, that the people whose lives, whose stories, just like we are intersecting with the story of Jesus through his best friend John, so our stories are colliding with the stories of other people. And there's divine plan at work that we have been called at this time, this space, this journey, this plan to point other people to the source of life. Like, don't miss that. Amidst the chaos and the craziness and the ups and downs and the 9 to 5 and the schedules and the ball games and the practices and the TV and the news and the political environment and all the things that are going on that grab and vie for our attention, don't miss that in this moment, this time, this place, God has strategically placed you to point people to Jesus. Amen. To be the light, to take the life that you have been given and to share that life with others. So this week, right, was a tough week in my life. I work an outside job. I won't get into all the details, but I had an extremely chaotic week. One of those like 13, 14-hour day weeks where I had like little time to breathe or think and a lot of chaos going on, like Wednesday, Thursday of my week, like insecurity about, man, what is this job even for me, and new boss, and new expectations, and all the craziness of life and chaos going around me, and having this conversation with Ash, like, late at night, when the only time I can be home, and having this conversation, like, what's the next step, like, what's the plan, what's the chaos going to bring, and again, I talk a lot about God's sovereignty, and then chaos happens in that moment, I'm like, I got to control this, and be in charge, and figure it out, and fix it, and that's our humanity, right? And so in the midst of all this, trying to pray and to seek God's guidance and to know what's the next step and what am I supposed to do in this situation, this environment. In the midst of all this, I was in the office and got engaged in this conversation that was initiated by another person who knows that I do this on weekends and have been in ministry for a large portion of my life, and that I've had some chaos in my story, and some time in ministry, out of ministry, and just all the things that most of you guys know about me. And so in the midst of all this, she starts asking me questions, right? What about this, or what about this verse, or what about this? And I want to get into a lot of detail in case she watches this message, but in the midst of all the craziness was God had placed me in the path of someone that was very broken. Broken on the inside, that had a really tough shell to protect the brokenness on the inside. You know what I'm talking about? And so in the midst of a 45-minute conversation, you're able to peel away the layers and say, let's talk about what's really going on. Like, let's talk about beyond the surface. Let's talk about beyond the persona. Let's talk about the brokenness of your heart. And here is the gospel. Amidst the craziness. And I'm on my phone after texting Ashley saying, in the middle of the chaos, I'm reminded, in this moment, in this time, God put me on this path for this second, for this person. Who knows future and long term? Who knows any of that? But what I know is in this journey with a lot of chaos and uncertainty and why am I here and not here and trying to figure it all out, in the midst of all of that was God saying to me, right now, in this moment, right here, I've got you sitting across from a broken person. And I need you to be Jesus. I need you to forget all this. And I need you to be here in this moment. Like, what if I'd missed that moment? Like, what if amidst the craziness I had thought, I don't have time for this, or I'm not in a good place mentally to have this conversation, or what if my flesh in that moment and all the feelings I was having about the situation I was in, which, you know, I am your pastor, but like, you know that reality about me, right? And so what if in the midst of all that craziness I had not hit the pause button? But there I was, just like you, amidst the chaos, with an opportunity to be the light. Like, don't miss your opportunities. Don't miss your moments. I don't know what's even going to happen out of all the chaos. If you guys know of any job opportunities, let me know. I'm just kidding. But I do know that I was a dead person spiritually. I do know that I was a deeply wounded person for a season of my life. I do know I was a broken person. And I know Jesus brought me to life. And I know he healed me. And I know he redeemed me. And I know there's other broken, hurt people that need to hear the same story of redemption and healing. Because I was sitting in her chair not too many years ago. And so the opportunity to be the gospel, right? John brings us into that story. And he lets us hear. Amidst the chaos, amidst the fear, amidst the brothers with their own agenda, there's a message of hope and belief and life and forgiveness. And he says to us today, keep it going. Continue what I began. Keep your eyes open in your space and know the opportunities God's putting in your path to be Jesus, to talk Jesus, to live gospel, to be light, to speak life.